How would you like to attend a conference and hear Matt Harrison, Craig Parton, Jonathan Fisk, Will Wheaton, Chris Roseborough, and Al Schmidt? You're invited to the 2014 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 13th and 14th in Collinsville, Illinois. Registration is $100 per person. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 13th and 14th in Collinsville, Illinois. issuesetc.org. Well, we're coming up on that weekend of Father's Day. And of course, all the cliches prevail at a time like this. For me, Father's Day, not for me personally, but for me looking out at a society where fatherhood is probably one of the most besieged institutions in terms of comedy, in terms of how people think of fathers, of the place of a man in the family, that I can think of. So every passing year means Father's Day is really just more and more irony in American society. We're going to salute our fathers while we think less of them every year. We're going to salute them while we are told repeatedly that they're completely unnecessary for family, for child rearing, for a healthy society, for the raising of children. Why don't we just drop the facade and drop Father's Day altogether? Mothers, on the other hand, considered necessary. Fathers, not so much. Joining us to talk about the social impact of fathers, Dr. Jennifer Roback Moore. She's founding president of the Ruth Institute, based in San Marcos, California. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities, and she's author of the books Smart Sex and Love and Economics. Jennifer, welcome back.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
As an economist, do you think that the changing view, the way not only we look at fathers socially, but also how fathers are dealt with in law, in society, cultural mores, do you think that the fall of fatherhood has had an economic impact?
Oh, Todd, no question about it. The fall of fatherhood has had an economic impact. I mean, there was a spate of think tanks who researched this question a couple of years ago, and they did studies for the United States, for the UK, for Canada, for New Zealand, and just asked, what's the taxpayer cost of fatherlessness? And in the United States, one of the studies came to the conclusion that it was the equivalent of the GDP of New Zealand is what the taxpayers lost each year in taxpayer costs owing to fatherless families. And the reason for that is that the mother-father bond is the most basic form of social cooperation, right? And economists like to think about the whole economy as a big system of social cooperation, and you've got your big companies that have thousands of people working together for the good of some particular goal and some particular end. But mom and dad working together is the most basic unit of social cooperation. And when we go and break that down, there's a whole lot of stuff that either doesn't get done or doesn't get done as well because mom's trying to do it all by herself, or mom's trying to do it with the help of her mom and dad, who maybe are older and don't have the same kinds of personal and human resources maybe that the dad might bring to the table. And so there's just a lot of loss and cost in the sense of lost opportunity, that the opportunity for the man to contribute to the family, that's lost. The opportunity for the child to have a relationship with his father, all the benefits that he would get from that is lost. The health benefits to mothers and fathers both from cooperating rather than not cooperating, all of that is lost. So it's an enormous series of losses when you go in and you take that most basic structural social unit and bust it apart. It's like a destructive force. It's like breaking the atom. You know, all this destructive energy comes out from breaking apart something that was really belonged together.
You recently testified in advance of some legislation in the state of Illinois, and you had a pretty remarkable insight as to the impact of fatherlessness or the benefit a child has in knowing his biological father. And The insight really centered around the fact that, you know, if you are the well-heeled suburban single mom or the Washington, D.C. or New York socialite who says, I don't need a man, I pay my nanny for that kind of stuff. It's very easy to talk about not needing a father, but there's a whole other strata of society that is deeply affected by this. What did you have to say?
Yes, that's right. That's right. And this was when I was testifying in Illinois when they were talking about removing the gender requirement from marriage. And, you know, some of my friends who work in Illinois, who work with some of the family policy groups here in Illinois, told me the impact that this statement of mine had. I didn't know because I was sitting there reading my testimony, you know, and I'm looking up. And I'm not looking up. I couldn't see the reaction around the room. But my friends told me that it really had an impact. And what I said was, you know, if you're going to say that mothers and fathers don't really matter, that they're really interchangeable, you're really saying that kids don't need a dad, kids don't need a mom and a dad. And I just challenged them. I said, are you really prepared to go into the neighborhoods, the poor neighborhoods on the south side of Chicago, and tell those people that they don't really need a dad, that their biological father is irrelevant to them, and that all they need is, you know, two people who love them, two people, whoever they might be, who love them, and that fatherhood's irrelevant? And what my friends told me as they looked around the room is that a lot of the Caucasian legislators and lobbyists were kind of snickering and eye-rolling, and, you know, when I said that. But many of the African-American legislators were nodding in agreement, you know, because they know what a problem fatherlessness is in their community, and that redefining marriage so that the father role is defined out of it and the mother role is defined out of it, and all you have is generic parents of whatever gender. You know, they just couldn't really believe that was plausible, that that would work. Well, it looks like as a society, we're going to find out whether it works or not. But the fact is, the overall picture is that pretty much everything you can think of within the sexual revolution has been much, much harder on the poor than it has been on the upper classes and the elites who champion the sexual revolution. Whether it's divorce or single parenthood or any of those kinds of things, the rich people can get away with it, and the poor people do not have the resources to fritter away with a lot of upheaval and turnover in their personal relationships. And so when they have a turnover or a transition, that's the euphemism sometimes used for it, when they have a relationship transition, it costs them a lot, and they don't have the resources to fall back on. And so it's systematically, you see that all of these things have fallen more heavily on the lower classes. So that's the crisis of fatherhood is something that has greatly harmed the lower classes in our society.
What role has the change in divorce law had on fathers?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because claiming that no fault, that we don't need to assign fault anymore to divorce, has done a couple of things. I mean, in a sense, what it's ended up doing is bringing the government into the family in a way that it was never possible before. And people might think that's ironic, because they think, well, we're more free now if we don't have to give a reason for why we're getting divorced. Why is it the government's business why we're getting divorced? Well, the old fault-based rules had a presumption that the marriage was permanent. And if you wanted it to be not permanent, you had to have a reason, and you had to have evidence. You had to be able to show if somebody had committed a marital fault, usually adultery or abuse or abandonment. You know, those would be the kind of things that were pretty much in every jurisdiction. Those would count as grounds for divorce. But when you bring in no fault, people don't have to give a reason. People don't have to provide evidence. And so what you have is the faulting party is the one who benefits under that rule. You know, so the presumption that the marriage is permanent, that goes away. The presumption that marriage is faithful, fidelity, that presumption goes away, because for all practical purposes, there's no penalty for adultery. So the adulterous spouse is not treated any differently than the faithful spouse. And so, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's the man or the woman who's at fault. The faulting party is benefited by that. But the other thing that has happened is that the state is invited into the home when there is a dispute over divorce. And what I mean by that is that many, many divorces are not by mutual consent, but in fact are against the wishes of one of the parties. And so quite often the state then comes into the family to say, okay, you are not allowed to be part of the family anymore because your wife wants a divorce, so we are going to make sure you don't come back, and we're going to make sure that the property is divided, and we're going to make sure that you see your kids only this amount of time and that amount of time. And so what's happening is that a blameless person, quite often the father, a blameless person, is kept away from his property, his children, by the actions of the state, you know. And the cases I'm talking about here are cases where no fault has been committed or even alleged, right? And so that's what it means to say the person is blameless. So it's not that that the person's guilty of some kind of abuse or something like that. It's just one person doesn't want to be married anymore, and so the assets of the family have to be divided up, and that's what the state comes in to do. So that's had a very big and negative impact on the role of the stability of marriage, which in turn means that fatherhood is diminished.
Is there a way, going forward, given the fact that marriage itself, parenthood, is being actively redefined or defined out of existence in legislatures, in courts, in state Supreme Courts, is there a way to retain fatherhood so that 25 years from now, Father's Day isn't just a quaint memory out there? What was that all about? We used to celebrate such a thing.
Yes, I think this is a very good opportunity for your listeners who have been estranged from their fathers in some way or separated from their fathers in some way. Father's Day is a good opportunity to reach out in healing and forgiveness and reconciliation, whatever might be appropriate for your case. This is a good time. Father's Day is a good day for you to reach out to your father or your mother or wherever the breach might have been in your family. And I'm speaking to the Issues Etc. listeners because I know that your listeners are resolute people. They're solid people. They're people who are courageous and want to do the right thing and who want to live the gospel of Jesus Christ. And I can't think of a better way for you to live the gospel of Jesus Christ than to reach out in forgiveness across any kind of breaches that may have taken place in your own family. Because there's something so powerful about forgiveness and apology, you know, asking forgiveness, giving forgiveness, whichever end of the thing you're on, for you, Issues Etc. listeners, for you to take the first step and reach out, that will be a very powerful gift that you can give yourself and your family and the wider society. And that's what's absolutely got to happen. There's no public policy that can substitute for that spiritual reality of reconciliation and healing.
Finally, then, with only a minute, Jen, can a free society exist without a robust concept, both in its kind of common thinking, but also in its law of father, mother, parents?
Well, you know, we're about to find out, but I honestly don't think that it can, because the institution of mother, father, and children, that's a natural reality that predates any law, any legal system. It certainly predates the United States Constitution, and that exists to create a little society in every home. Every home has its own little society of mom, dad, and the kids. And what's happening to us is that the state is taking over more and more territory that belongs to the family, that's proper to the family. I read not too long ago that in Scotland, they're creating a policy of what they call named persons to oversee the care of children, even in families where there's been no alleged problem in the family. They're having named persons who will receive your child's medical care, your child's medical records. That will be sent out to this named person without your consent, you know. So they're a little bit further along, but what they're doing is taking over the function of the family because they're alleging that the family has broken down. Well, why is the family broken down? It's broken down because the elites, and particularly the government, have been kicking it and knocking it down and banging it down. That's why it's fallen. And now, once again, acting as both arsonist and firefighter, the state comes in to rescue and repair the damage that the state itself is responsible for.
Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris is founding president of the Ruth Institute based in San Marcos, California. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities, and she's author of the book Smart Sex and Love in Economics. You can find out more about the Ruth Institute under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Thank you, Jennifer.
You're welcome, Chad.
Folks, the premier conference for the laity begins this Friday at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville, Illinois. It's the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. We have Pastor Matt Harrison, Craig Parton, Jonathan Fisk, Pastor Will Whedon, Chris Rosebro, and Dr. Alvin Schmidt. You can still register. It's too late for the meal plan, but you can still attend. The registration fee is $75. We usually allow about 90 minutes for meals, and there are plenty of restaurants in the area. If you'd still like to register for the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, go to issuesetc.org or call Craig 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June the 13th and Saturday, June the 14th, right here in Collinsville, Illinois. Looking forward to seeing you there. We just passed 300 registrations, and that means there's still plenty of room. But of course, the meal plan is no longer available. Register for only $75. And we do take walk-ins as well, even on Friday night, issuesetc.org. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll talk with Pastor Bill Swirl about the promises of God during suffering, and we'll discuss barrenness with Katie Schuerman. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Hello, this is Pastor Kevin Golden of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri. The saints at Village Lutheran are proud to be part of the Issues Etc. 300, sharing in their Christ-centered, cross-focused proclamation of the gospel. If you find yourself in St. Louis, join us on Sundays at 8:15 and 10:45 for the Divine Service, 9:30 for Bible study and Sunday school, as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation. Or visit us on the web at www.villagelutheranchurch.org.